HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to the Investor Hour podcast. I'm your host, Rahul Goyal. The goal of this podcast is to learn from the best investment minds of our times. We want to learn their backstory, essentially, what makes them, them. We want to learn how they make their decisions in their personal lives. And of course, we want to learn about their core principles of investing. Essentially, a lot of learning that could help you make better decisions in life and investing. Talking to Gautam Baid, author of Joys of Compounding, is both inspirational and thought-provoking. He went from working a night shift at a hotel reception to becoming one of the most widely followed money managers. Sheer hard work and grit led him to perfect a style of stock picking and portfolio building that has worked wonders in the last several years. Gautam and I talk about his approach and also about India and, of course, compounding.
So, Gautam, welcome to the Equity Master Investor Hour. It's a delight to have you. Just a couple of weeks back, in fact, I finished reading your wonderful, wonderful book, The Joys of Compounding. And it was extremely thought-provoking at so many levels. And so I thought that, you know, I have to reach out to you and get you on the podcast so you can share all the wonderful wisdom with our, you know, listeners and viewers. So I'm so glad that we finally got a chance to do that.
Thank you for having me, Rahul. Looking forward to this discussion. Should be fun.
Yeah, should be fun. Okay. Let me start off with a little bit of your background. And I'll give you the reason why I tend to go into a little bit of the background is because when we are talking to, you know, gurus like yourselves, very interesting stories come up about what the environment in the house was, or what was the investing acumen in the house, you know, when they were growing up, and which kind of influenced their investing styles or exposure to the stock markets. So if you could maybe start with that, that would be a wonderful way to kick this off.
Sure. So I was born and brought up in a Marwari family in Calcutta. And as you very well know, the Marwari community in India has got business in its genes. So ever since my childhood years, I was very fascinated by the concept of entrepreneurship and business, mm-hmm. especially the fact that once a solid foundation is established for a business, the owners do not work for money. Rather, money works for them. Yeah. I did my graduation with a specialization in accountancy, and I did my BCom honors. So pursuing higher studies in the field of finance seemed like a natural extension. So I did my MS in finance, a long distance learning program from ICFI University, Hyderabad, India. And I also did my MBA in finance from Nirma University, Ahmedabad, India. Later on, I also went on to get my CFA charter from the CFA Institute, US. After my MBA program got over, I got a campus placement with Citibank at their Mumbai office as an investment banking analyst. And from there on, I joined Deutsche Bank as a senior analyst in their investment banking team, where I worked for around 4 years. Now, all throughout the first 7 years of my investment banking career, I was making pretty good money by Indian standards, but I was not really getting that job satisfaction. Mm-hmm. The irony is that many people confuse happiness with earning a lot of money. And you get this wisdom only after you actually become pretty rich and once you achieve financial independence, that it was not about money at all. It was only about gaining control over your time and about being able to live the life which you want to live, not directed by someone else. So that is what financial independence basically means to me. As regards the environment in the household, it was a pretty middle-class upbringing. But what basically the pretty good fortune which I had was that in 2013, that is when I started to learn about value investing. From between 2007 and 2013, I was basically more into short-term trading and I didn't have much idea what I was actually doing. As is the case of most investors in the market, I made my beginning in the Indian stock markets during the final euphoric phases of a bull market. So in my case, it was the 2003 to 2007 bull market in India. I still remember I had invested in a mutual fund called Reliance Power Sector Mutual Fund in late 2007 and a stock named Ispat Steel in early 2008. Mm-hmm. The reason was that both of these particular investments had sharply appreciated in a very quick span of time when I first observed them. Now, recency and vividness biases are very powerful but highly costly behavioral mistakes. I didn't pay any heed to the valuations or the underlying business models of these companies, and I paid the price. Both these investments crashed 70 to 80% within the next 12 to 18 months of my purchase, and I had successfully gained admission into the stock markets by paying my tuition fee. Now, my father was observing that I was very interested in this whole stock market activity between 2007 and 2013. So he said, "This is my portfolio, son. Why don't you have a look at it and see what you can do?" It was in hindsight, today, that time I didn't realize it, but in hindsight, my father's portfolio was basically full of all these junk stocks. And in fact, he had a very bad image about the stock market because he had lost almost 70 to 80% of his cumulative investments in the Indian stock market during his 20-year investing journey. So he had basically no hope. He just, I think out of just seeing the keen interest that his son had, he just let me handle his portfolio. It was pretty small sum at the time. But that is how I basically got the small initial capital to work with in the stock market. And all throughout the first 7 years of my professional investment banking career, despite the initial setback of losing so much money, my interest about the Indian stock markets always remained very high. And one fine day, I came to the realization that I just have this one short life to live my dream. And I did not want to waste any further time doing something that I was not truly passionate about. So I quit my job with Deutsche Bank. And I relocated to the US in May 2015 without any job in hand. So one of my relatives, he's a US citizen. He sponsored my green card. And I was under the impression that since I'm a CFA charter holder, I should be able to easily land a starting role in the stock market because this particular degree is highly valued in the stock market industry. But as you know, life is not a bed of roses for those trying to carve their own destiny. I got rejected in my first three stock market job interviews in the first 6 months of coming to the US, but I did not give up. I was very firm and adamant that I'm not going to go back to that previous field of work of investment banking, where the presence of incentive cost bias and, you know, perverse incentives just led to constant conflicts of interest and did not suit my personal nature. So I kept declining all the investment banking job interview calls that I was getting in the US, even though they would have had very high dollar salaries. At the same time, I obviously hid this fact from my parents and my family in India, otherwise they would have thought that I've gone nuts. And at the same time, I ran out of whatever little money I brought with me from India. Now, I had a choice to make. I could either sell a portion of my stocks in India and take care of my living expenses in the US and interrupt the process of compounding, or I could take the hard path and just figure out to do something to earn a living, just to put food on the table while I look for a stock market job. So I opted for the latter, and I joined a job as a front desk hotel clerk at a hotel in San Francisco. It was the Four Points by Sheraton, San Francisco Bay Bridge, where I worked for 15 months. And even though it was a big challenge for me, intellectually, culturally, emotionally, physically, in hindsight, I highly value those days of my life. Because I remember I used to work during the graveyard shift. Now, for all the audience who don't know what a graveyard shift means, it was the shift at the hotel running from 11 p.m. at night to 7 a.m. in the morning. And the pace of work was pretty slow during that particular time. So I made full use of the free time to read every single blog article published till from inception till date on blogs like Safal Niveshak, Jana WordPress, Bay State Investing, Faddu Professor, and Microgap Club, among others. And the passionate pursuit of lifelong learning had finally begun. Now, here I would like to take a pause and briefly talk about the power of passion with you, Rahul. Remember, during those 15 months, every single night, I used to apply to a minimum of 3 stock market jobs online. So if you just do the simple math, I'd applied to more than 1,300 stock market jobs over the course of those 15 months. Now, as all of us know, whenever we take out time to, you know, fill out the job application, attach a resume, and every single time we click the submit button, there is so much hope and anticipation behind every single submission that this may be it. Now I will finally get the call. Now I will finally get the interview call. But to be able to persist and keep on going instead of 1,300 rejections, being rejected more than 1,300 times, this is only and only possible if you're absolutely fanatically dedicated and passionate, fiercely passionate about what you want to pursue in life. I doubt I could do that same act today again, but that time I was like a man possessed. I was absolutely just consumed by this thought that I want to do just this. I want to get on the stock market side. So be passionate and don't give up, because compounding will bestow its benefits and its magic upon you only after testing your patience and conviction to the fullest. Now, luck, chance, serendipity, and randomness have always played a big role in various aspects of my life till date. One fine night during November 2016, during the course of my routine daily job search, I randomly clicked on the quick apply button on a job application on LinkedIn. And wonder of wonders, I was shortlisted for the job interview, and that too for a senior role in an asset management company, even though I had zero formal stock market work experience. And this was the phase in my life during which I was about to experience the power of compounding knowledge in action. You see, all those hundreds of hours spent during the previous 15 months at the hotel had now built a strong intellectual foundation for me in investing. This is what I was lacking during my first 6 months in US when I was rejected in those three stock market job interviews. And this time I was able to clear all the three rounds of my job interview. And there's a reason for that. It's because body language derives from self-confidence, and self-confidence in turn derives from knowledge. And I was offered the role of portfolio manager of global equity strategy at Summit Global Investments. And it was like a dream come true for me. And I never expected to land the role of a portfolio manager straight away. I thought I'll be hired as a junior analyst, then get promoted to an analyst, then senior analyst, and then assistant portfolio manager. And then probably after 13, 14 years, reach the level of a portfolio manager. But this is the magic of compounding again. Just if you just keep persisting all the time, magical things do happen in life. This happened with me as well. Now, during the course of my 5 years of tracking global stock markets as part of the global equity strategy as portfolio manager, India as a market very clearly stood out to me in terms of the high growth opportunities which it offered and the long runway for growth ahead. And so last year in July, after working for 4.5 years at Summit Global, I quit my job and ventured out on my own to set up a India focus fund in the US. And at the same time, to help the retail investor fraternity in India, I also set up a small case in which I provide a curated list of stocks for people to buy. So that in a nutshell is my journey, Rahul.
That's a very, very interesting journey. So a few points from there that I made a note of. One is that Kolkata has a long history of producing some of India's best stock market people, right? I think the even if you go back all the way to the 80s and 90s, some of the biggest brokers who were participants in the market were all from Calcutta. So I don't know whether that had some something in the air to expose you to the stock markets or not. Yes, but you, of course, didn't go the broking route. You went the long-term value route.
Yes. So let me share a personal story again here. So one of my earliest inspirations, I still remember, between 2012 and 2013, one of my earliest inspirations in the stock market was the late Binkam Chand Lamboria. He was my best friend's father at the time. He's no more, but I still remember I used to go to his house, and I had very little understanding of what fundamental analysis actually means, but he used to just effortlessly be so analytical about investing in the stock market. I still remember I used to sit on the floor. He used to sit on his bed. I used to sit on the floor in front of him and take notes and just try to just absorb all the wisdom that I could from him. So that was also, he was also a big, big inspirational force behind me getting into the stock market. So the Calcutta connection comes right there.
Yeah. Another connection I can tell you is I also graduated from the ICFA Hyderabad. They used to offer a twin degree. I had done that. You know, they used to do the MBA CFA together those days, 20 years ago. So incidentally, I did that as well. So I think what you shared was very fascinating, primarily because I think at the start of your career, you've been through a journey which is a tough learning, right? Successive failures, be it the stocks, be it the applications. What kind of a support system did you have going for you at that point in time? I know you said you were a man possessed and you were like going, but there must have been people. I don't know whether you were married by then, you're married now. Sorry, I don't know all that, but what kept you going all that while, apart from the passion to become a portfolio manager?
No, actually the support system was not really there, to be honest. In fact, it is only during your difficult times that you get to, that you make your friends and, you know, personal family relatives for life. That is when you get to know that who's actually going to be with you during your difficult times. During good times, everyone will be with you, but it is only during the difficult times that you get to know who's actually going to back you. It is those people who trust you, who have conviction in you, and who believe in you. They are the ones who will back you. And that is why I think most people make their best friends for life during such difficult phases. So it was only my passion. I still remember during those 15 months, I used to stay in a depleted single room as a PG, as a paying guest, because that was all I could afford. San Francisco is one of the most expensive real estate markets in the world. And that was the only thing that I could afford, because mind you, I was working for minimum wages in the one of the world's most expensive cities. So just to make ends meet and to have a roof over my head, that is the struggles that I went through. But in hindsight, I think they were very valuable, and I'm very thankful to them, because it's only because of those past hard experiences that I have this constant attitude of gratitude all the time, that I just feel grateful for every single thing, for even the normal things in life. I just feel so grateful now, because those days, I still remember, it's tough to talk about this, but there were times when I used to eat smaller portions of my meals just to make meals last for 3 times a day. I was so dedicated to just somehow trying to make ends meet and not selling anything from my Indian portfolio. I just wanted to gain control over my time, and I wanted to become financially independent. And by God's grace, things have worked out very well. And I was also very thankful. Again, it's good to acknowledge all the good that you have in life. That is the key to lasting happiness. And because I got such a high-paying job as a portfolio manager, and I was able to save so much, I anyways have a very frugal lifestyle. And the only single item which I actually splurge on is my vacations and holidays. So next week, for example, I'm traveling to Singapore for a week with my wife. And this is what I'm really loving about life right now. I can do whatever I want to do with my time. There is no schedule on my calendar. There are no meetings. I can just do whatever I want to do.
All well deserved. All well deserved after all the hard work. So wonderful. So one more thing from that initial discussion. You must be a guru on hotel stocks for sure. You know everything about hotels after having spent 15 months over there. Anyways, okay.
Thing which amateur investors make, that if they like a product or like a hotel's fancy interiors, they just think that will be a good stock. But hotels are one of the most, in Warren Buffett's words, one of the most gruesome businesses, because they are very, very capital intensive. Mm-hmm. Now, ideally, you should avoid capital intensive businesses, because they just become what Munger calls a frozen corporation. They just keep guzzling cash all the time. You want a business which can throw up a lot of cash, either pay it out as dividend or do a share buyback. If the share is trading below intrinsic value or trading at cheap valuations, do a share buyback. If you don't have internal investment opportunities, do a dividend. But the ideal business to own is one which can reinvest this cash flow within the business at higher returns on capital. That in turn becomes a compounding machine. So let me share the 3 attributes of a high quality business with you right now. Sure. It's very simple. There's nothing fancy about this, but this is the holy grail of long-term investing. A high quality business is one which earns a high return on invested capital, well above the cost of capital. Simple. That's the first point. The second point is the company should have some form of a competitive advantage or a moat, which enables it to maintain that spread between the return on capital and the cost of capital for a long period of time. And number 3, and most important, the company should have sufficient number of reinvestment opportunities within the business at high returns on capital. That's it. And the intrinsic compounding of any business is the reinvestment rate multiplied by the return on incremental invested capital. I'll again repeat. The intrinsic value creation of any business is the reinvestment rate of the cash flows multiplied by the return on incremental invested capital. That's it. Over the long run, your returns will approximate this particular number.
Just to break that up a little bit more with the help of an example. So suppose, let's take a company, Hindustan Lever, and let's make up a number that it has a return on capital of 50% and is generating a lot of cash. So what you're saying is that all the cash that it generates, if it's pulling back in its business, it better be making 50% or more on that new money as well.
Yes.
And if it's not, it should be giving back the money as dividend or buying back shares. The other thing you mentioned is moat. I think we all have heard moat like a million times over our lifetimes. Can you shed a moment more talking about moats, and also maybe give a few examples on what a true moat is vis-a-vis as, you know, moats which look like moats but not really are true moats?
So high market share is not a moat. For example, you cannot say that, you know, Maruti in India has got not a stock recommendation, has got a very high market share, but that's not necessarily a moat.
Yeah.
The true test of a moat is for a company to have pricing power. If you can raise your pricing from your customers in excess of the existing rates of inflation, then you have got true pricing power. That is the quality of a very good business. And those, that pricing power comes from certain sources. For example, network effects, high switching costs, or you know, having a proprietary technology or some kind of a proprietary advantage. So those are the few competitive advantages which lead to pricing power. The true test of a moat is pricing power. Also, if you, many brands are basically, are such that they come in and out of favor. So in US, you had Crocs footwear, just came in and out of favor. That's not a moat. And also, there are many technologies like GoPro in the US, for example, they did not have any customer lock-in. So even though it enjoyed high market share and high favor with customers for a short period of time, because it did not have any customer lock-in, so that's why I just faded into oblivion. So just high market share without customer lock-in, again, is not a moat. You want to basically just have such a compelling value proposition that the customer keeps coming back to you again and again. You have to either have share of mind or large, basically your brand recall should be very, very high. That can give you some pricing power. For example, in India, you have got, again, not a stock recommendation, but Manyavar is a very lead, strong consumer brand in wedding retail. And they have got great pricing power. In fact, they don't give a single rupee of discount on any of their pieces. That's one of the clearest signs that this is a very strong brand, because many apparel retailers in India occasionally offer discounts, but Manyavar never gives even a single rupee of discount. What does that just commonsensically tells us that here there is a very strong brand with pricing power at play. The valuations are expensive though. It's now trading at almost 100 times trailing PE. But in India, what I've also learned is that if you are sure, if you have deep conviction about the sustainability of the moat and the runway for growth ahead, and that the company can maintain these high returns on capital for a long period of time, then even if you pay 60, 70 times entry P multiple, you still end up making good money, because the price ratio does not deviate.
Yeah. So that's one thing I really want to spend time on discussing with you. It also happened in an earlier podcast. A lot of our viewers have grown up as investors thinking about buying cheap and holding till they make the money, right? But what has conclusively been proven in India over the last so many years, that strategy is not foolproof by any chance. In fact, on the flip side, the strategy of buying quality businesses, even if at a premium, works out far better. Goes back to the famous Buffett quote, which I don't know why it didn't register in this context for most of us, is that it's better to buy a good company at a fair price than to buy a fair company at a good price. And look, Buffett went and bought Apple, and he's still done phenomenally well. And, while all people were saying you shouldn't buy such expensive stocks, those people, just these companies are so good, they retain their valuation, and yet on all operating parameters, they're doing very well. So let's spend a few minutes just talking about this idea, because firstly, it's an anathema to most people. Why would you buy expensive? How will you make money? So talk to us a little bit about that. And let's talk, we're not discussing recommendations at all. Let's just talk history about companies which have remained pricey and the reasons thereof, and maybe interlacing it with because they had the high ROIC, the moats, the reinvested capital point.
Right. So very simple example here is the stock of Nestle. 20 years ago, it was also trading at a 60, 65 times P multiple. Today also trading at similarly same valuation. The key here is, here I would like to share two great white papers for anyone trying to understand. We should, as investors, try to understand what is the justified P multiple or the justified valuation multiple for a given business. Okay. And for that, there are two white papers. I'll share the names right now with you. The first white paper is a great white paper by Michael Morbison. It is titled, "What Does the Price to Earnings Multiple Mean?" That's the first white paper. I've talked about this in my book as well. The second white paper is by Epoch Investment Partners. It's titled, "The P Ratio, A User's Manual." What both these white papers do is they show you that for a given level of earnings growth and a given level of return on invested capital, what should be the justified P multiple of a business? And you'll notice that as the return on invested cap, there is just two key takeaways from both these white papers. I'll share the holy grail of valuation with you right now. In the stock market, there are two kinds of businesses. One with high returns on invested capital and one with low returns on invested capital. Now, for those businesses with low returns on invested capital, they should focus on improving the return on invested capital, because that is when the maximum delta, the maximum rate of change, the maximum intrinsic value creation takes place. When a business moves from low returns on invested capital to higher returns on invested capital, the focus should be on improving the return on invested capital. Okay. The second kind of business, the business which is already having high returns on invested capital, those kind of businesses should focus on improving their top line growth or revenue growth. Because in such kind of businesses with high returns on invested capital, the maximum delta, the maximum rate of change, the maximum intrinsic value creation takes place when they focus on improving revenue growth. That is, this is the holy grail of investing in the stock market. If you can understand this, you shall do very, very well. And the first category of companies moving from low returns on invested capital to high returns on invested capital, those kind of companies fall within a framework which we follow at Star Level Partners. That framework is called varying perception. Varying perception refers to situations where you get ROC expansion coupled with earnings growth, and you get valuation re-rating, and you end up with multi-baggers. And varying perception comes from having a differentiated view on the short to medium term trajectory of a business. And there are multiple triggers for varying perception. Number one, a product mix change in a high margin category, deleveraging, because as your debt goes down, interest cost goes down, net profit goes up, market gap goes up. Industry cycle shift. So since middle of 2020, you have had the residential real estate cycle in India turning around, and you have had multiple multi-baggers coming from the building material space. Government regulatory change. So since 2020, the government of India has given a heavy emphasis on ethanol blending, and you have had so many multi-baggers coming from the sugar mills and distillery space. Divestiture of a non-core business segment is another source for varying perception, because the stock markets like focus businesses and they reward those businesses with a higher valuation multiple. Divestiture of a loss-making business segment is another source, because as the loss-making business gets sold, net profit goes up, market gap goes up. Corporate actions are a great source of varying perception. So you've got demergers, you've got promoter and management change, you have merger arbitrage, multiple sources for varying perception. There's one more source, improvement in asset turns. You can get this information from the management on conference calls. You can ask them what is the expected turnover on the new fixed asset capacity. And ROC expansion comes from either margin improvement or improvement in asset turns. And between the two, I prefer the latter, because high margins tend to attract competition. Now, this was all about varying perception, about companies going from low returns on capital to higher returns on capital. That's the first point. The second one, companies with higher returns on capital. Okay, those are, they should focus on revenue growth. Those are found in long-term structural trends. The second investment theme, which I follow at Star Level Partners. So long-term structural trends are found in industries with a very favorable structure. They're organized like a monopoly or a duopoly or an oligopoly at best. And they're experiencing some form of an industry tailwind. They have a long runway for growth. So you have high visibility for many years ahead. You have consistency and predictability of cash flows. They are also characterized by value migration. So for the last 20 years in India, we have had value migration from unorganized to organized, public to private, offline to online. And there are multiple structural growth plays available in the Indian market today, namely contract research and manufacturing services, contract development and manufacturing organizations, affordable housing, fintech, music streaming, digital transformation, cloud computing, electric vehicles. Multiple mega trends are in play. And a portfolio well made is one which is made up of mega trends, which basically provide for long-term compounding, coupled with shorter-term tactical opportunities based on varying perception. This is how you basically construct a good portfolio as a fund manager. You should have a blend ideally of both, compounding machines as well as short-term tactical trends. And again, India, I repeat, from my experience, I have seen this enough. I started off by reading Benjamin Graham and forgot that he had written The Intelligent Investor against the backdrop of the Great Depression. That investing does not work in India. That investing works more on the liquidation theory of liquidation of companies and companies selling below net working capital. And those kind of businesses generally are the bad damaged businesses. And value investing is not about buying bad or damaged businesses or businesses in decline cheap. Because the underlying earnings is in disarray. Companies which are losing relevance with their primary customer base are what I call crumbling castles. Basically, they're just are completely out of trend, the current trends, and this they are just losing relevance with the customer. Don't fall for the value traps. They are basically like melting ice cubes. Instead, go for quality with growth. Quality is shown by the return on invested capital, along with some kind of a competitive advantage and growth. Quality of growth is equally important as the rate of growth itself. So you don't want to buy a business which is growing at 40-50% but earning below its cost of capital, because those kind of businesses are destroying shareholder value. I would rather prefer a business which is having 30-40% return on invested capital growing at 15% rather than the other way around, because those kind of businesses destroy value.
Yeah. So in this context, you mentioned Nestle as an example of a high PE company that has remained a high PE company. When to a viewer or to a listener, if they're trying to figure out when to get into a high PE, I can understand the first example. You said two examples, right? Moving from low return on capital to high return on capital. I think fairly easy to understand, you know, company's going to become more profitable. So maybe you want to pay more money. In the second one, let's say a company like Nestle or Hindustan Lever, they have been growing for decades. You know, the mega trends are well known. But when is the time? How do you decide how much to pay for them? Or you just bet that, you know, I can get in at 65 and hopefully get out at 65, 20 years down the line, but then there'll be so much more earnings in it. That's the return I will make.
Good question.
How do you cross that hurdle? How do you cross a hurdle? Yeah.
It's actually very, I'll give you a very simple common sense answer. If the category is already mature and well penetrated, so for example, Colgate, Nestle, these kind of companies are already very mature businesses growing at 10-12% and large market caps. Those are not the kind of businesses I'm interested in. If you want to pay top dollar for a high return on invested capital business, buy it at a low market cap, but high market share in its segment. So you want to basically look for leaders which are dominating their niches, but are still available at a lower market cap.
Got it.
You don't basically buy companies with 50-60,000 crores or 1 lakh crore market caps, and which are already, for whom the growth rate has already slowed down.
Yeah.
Those are not the kind of businesses you want to invest in for wealth creation. Legacy businesses with high dividend yields are very good for preserving wealth, but they are not good at creating wealth. And that is our job at Spend Managers, primarily to create wealth for our investors. And the idea is, if you can somehow figure out a company dominating its niche, a very niche player, but at a very small market cap, you've got a potential multi-bagger in your hands.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. That clears it. So, So I hope the viewers have taken away that important point that high PE does not really mean expensive, and low PE does not really mean cheap, because it could be a value trap. Gautam, let's go through some questions regarding your investment journey again, right? Which was your first investment that you ever made? I hope it was not the power fund.
No, that only. Power fund. Mutual fund and then Ispat Steel stock in early 2000. January.
Yeah, and you already shared the lessons thereof, so I won't go through that. And were these also the biggest failures you've had as an investor, or was there any other failure that was even more instructive for you?
So the biggest quantum in absolute terms and absolute level of money lost was in a stock named Bandhan Bank, not a stock recommendation. I still remember I had read a book about its founder, Chandrasekhar Ghosh, and written by Tamil Bandyopadhyay. It was titled Bandhan, the Making of a Bank. And I developed one of the most insidious and harmful personal behavioral biases. It's called liking bias. I failed to separate the economics of the business from the personality of the promoter. And even though I was aware of the headwinds and the problems which the business was facing, I just kept ignoring all of that in the hope. Hope is a very dangerous word in the stock market. Hope investing is, in fact, one of the fastest ways to lose a lot of money in a very quick span of time. A few years ago, they were facing a lot of headwinds in their microfinance business in terms of collections. And even though I had all the news in front of me, all the disconfirming evidence was there in front of me, driven by my liking bias for the promoter, I just kept on ignoring all those negative news flow, and I eventually incurred a massive loss in monetary terms. And I'll remember, and again, it was a pretty large position for me. So it taught me one more lesson, that have a diversified portfolio. And today I follow a pretty diversified portfolio of 22 to 25 stocks. A few years ago, I used to have a very concentrated personal portfolio of just 5-6 stocks. In hindsight, I think once you've made a lot of money from the stock market, that is the time to actually spread out your bets a bit just play it safe and just let steady compounding do the work for you. No need to swing for the fences after you have already achieved financial independence. That was not required. Yeah. But that was a very valuable lesson.
Yeah, since you mentioned Bandhan Bank, when that came out, even I developed so-called a liking for that whole story. I, of course, didn't invest. We have a lot of regulation at Equity Master, so there was no question of buying the stock at that point. But I do recollect, didn't it have a crazy price-to-book value of like 4 or 5 times or something like that? It was a super premium valuation because I think everyone liked the story a lot. But I don't know how it's going to play out in the long term. But if you're paying such a high premium, then you better be sure that something extraordinary is going to happen. Otherwise, a lot of the gains are already factored in, right?
No, here I would like to add one great insight again from my investing journey. If you can get a financial company or a non-banking financial services company or a bank trading at a very high price to book and which has got a very high return on equity, if that kind of a company, if you're confident that it can dilute its capital, if it can raise capital at that high price to book while having a high return on equity, it can create tremendous shareholder value. Look at Bajaj Finance as a great example.
And goes back to the point you made, because if you're in reinvesting capital at that rate of return, it's just a fantastic business. And if they can raise money at that valuation at the high price to book. So yeah, that's a point well taken. You just mentioned that when you're starting off, you can be more concentrated. I guess the appetite for risk when you're starting off typically tends to be higher for most people. But when you come into some money, that's when you are a little more cautious and a little more diversified. We're going to talk about asset allocation in a bit, because I believe that that's something a lot of people don't really focus on, but that is very important to long-term wealth creation. We'll talk about that in a bit. Let's just go through a few more things. You're a young guy, but I'll still start way back. I'm going to ask you about where you were in certain periods of time, and how did you react, or what did you learn, or what did you see? So, should I start with the 91, 92 Harshad Mehta period? Were you like, you were a toddler, reading the papers coming to your house? Any memories of that period for you?
My father has got much more vivid memories. Even he was sucked into that particular bull market towards the very fag end, and he lost a lot of money. But that time, I didn't have much idea about the stock market, to be honest. I was just 9 years old that time, so I didn't have much idea about the stock market. But as you know, all of us have seen the scam series, and all of us now know about Harshad Mehta. Yeah. And the influence which he had in terms of galvanizing the retail investors in the country to actually put money to work in the stock market.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like clockwork. After every big, huge bull market, there are a series of scams. I've talked about this in my book as well, that after every bear market is characterized by a large number of scams which come out, sometimes even by the erstwhile blue chip companies. And this happens because during the bull markets, many corporates fall prey to greed.
Yeah.
And those the chickens come home to roost in the subsequent bear market. And that is when the investor has got a choice to either learn from his mistakes and finally they take strides towards gravitating towards quality, because after having lost a lot of money with fraudulent managements or bad business models, those are the biggest learnings which you take after every bear market. That's been in my case, at least between 2018 and 2019. If you remember, there was a plethora of corporate governance
It peaked with the ILFS issue. It peaked with the ILFS thing in September, October, I think in 2018 or 2019. Yeah.
It continued in 2019 also. And that is when I got to realize that India is not a market to take risk. Yeah. India is a market where you want to crush risk from as many angles as possible. You cannot crush the valuation risk. That's not in your hand, but you have to crush management risk, regulatory risk, government risk, balance sheet risk is a big, big thing again. So yeah. Cash flow risk. So India is not a market to take risk in, because if you take undue risk, you'll have your head handed back to you on a
platter.
India is a market where you want to, the only one single strategy which I've seen over the last 15 years, which has worked across market environments in India, is growth at a reasonable price. There is no other strategy which works across all time periods, except this one strategy, growth at a reasonable price. Just if you follow this for the long term, you should do very, very well in India.
What about the TMT collapse of 99-2000? Any memories of that?
So I had read about that in Maggie Meher's book called Bull, in which she talked about the dot-com bubble and subsequent bust. Yeah. So this time, again, having a very strong knowledge of financial history is an asset for any investor. And this is why I was able to avoid completely 100% the speculative mania, and these SPACs and NFTs and all the unprofitable tech stocks in US. Even though many people were making a lot of money at the time, but I was very disciplined. I did not venture out of my circle of competence, driven by the lure of quick short-term returns. I was disciplined in terms of valuations and sticking to quality stocks like Google, Microsoft, and Apple. And I was able to preserve my capital and grow it at the same time. So I was able to avoid all that mania because I had read about the dot-com bubble.
Yeah. And then we come to the great financial crisis, the crash, 2007-8, where you were part of it a little bit.
I still remember I had got a campus placement in March 2008, and I started my career in May 2008, just a few months before. Just a few months ago, and before the crash, and before Lehman went bankrupt. And I still remember I was working with Citigroup, and there was a point of time in March 2009 where Citigroup had fallen below $1, and it was kicked out of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And all of us in the company was so scared about our jobs, what will happen. And as you know, what we employees typically do is we used to work double the hours and just try to show to our bosses that, you know, we are very sincere and we are very hardworking. That truth is, we were very scared about our job security. We didn't get any bonuses for those few years, but at that time, the main priority was just to save the job at any cost and just let the income continue. So it was a very tough time to be an employee during such times. The capital was to invest was very small, but that time the focus was more on job security and being right in the middle of the action in the Citigroup, where a lot of the problems also surfaced.
Yep.
It was pretty brutal.
Yeah. And then, of course, the pandemic period. Let's talk a little bit about that. By then, you had gone through all this. You've read all the history. You've had some experiences. You've chiseled your investment style. You've been a portfolio manager, become independent. How was that for you? I know you mentioned you avoided all the SPACs and the NFTs, etc. But talk to us a little bit about that.
I think the single biggest, there are two big realizations I would like to share with you about the pandemic, which hit in March 2020. Which basically taught me that every year in January, the Economist and all these big magazines, they come out with the big forecasts for the year. And be it 2016, when Donald Trump was elected, or be it 2020, when the pandemic struck, none of those publications ever had COVID-19 or Donald Trump becoming president, as mentioned, as a key risk at the beginning of the year. So one of the single biggest realizations in this investment business for me is that the so-called seemingly impossible keeps happening every now and then with high
black swans. The black swan events are not really black swan events. They're more regular.
So basically, the only way to survive a world which is interspersed with black swans and the unpredictable and the unforeseeable is to have a very durable, solid portfolio of businesses. I mean, that's the only single defense which you have in your arsenal as an investor. Build a portfolio of very durable, strong businesses and take care of your personal behavior. If you can do just these two things and survive for the long term in the stock market, you can't help but become rich. I'll give you numbers here. If you look at the history of any major stock market in the world, like US, Japan, or China, whenever those economies' GDP doubled from 2.5 trillion to 5 trillion, their stock markets did not just double. Their stock market tripled or quadrupled. And why is that? Because when any nation transitions from a low-income country to a middle-income country, the basic spending on items like food does not go up, but the spending on discretionary branded consumption and financialization of savings, those categories just explode. And today, India is at 2.8 trillion, on the way to 5 trillion. We are right in the middle of this, just about to start our journey. This is when the fastest pace of wealth creation and the biggest wealth creation in the stock market takes place. So this, even if over the next decade, the market cap to GDP in India just approximates 1 over time, nothing fancy, we simply take that simple assumption. You can just envisage the kind of wealth creation that lies in store for investors in great Indian businesses. Trillions of dollars. We are talking trillions of dollars in market cap addition here. This is the time to think big. This is the time to change your life for the better than over the next decade. As India grows, we will grow disproportionately. Linear growth, but non-linear disproportionate opportunities. This is what India offers to the world investors today. That's why I'm so excited to bring the India investment opportunity to investors in America through my fund. I think India's got a very good time ahead of it.
So I think that's very exciting to hear. But You've explained your investing style, right? You've shared all your journey and how you've been through it. Elements of your investment style overlap with what, you know, some other gurus may also say. So what makes your style of stock picking unique to you? What is the delta that becomes unique to Gautam's, you know, effort?
Very good question. And again, very simple answer. The best investment strategy for any investor is the one which he or she can stick with for the longest period of time without panicking during bear markets and without letting the occasional bull markets go to their heads. That is the optimal investment strategy. So for me, for example, I feel very comfortable with 20-25 stocks in my portfolio. Some people feel very comfortable with even 5-6 stocks in their portfolio. Do what suits your temperament and your personality. The key here is stick to what you can continue for a long period of time. That is the compounding is a lifelong journey and stock market is a very long-term game. The key to becoming rich in the stock market is not to get thrown out midway because of reckless decisions. Those reckless decisions are caused by impatience, greed, FOMO, or fear of missing out, and not having a proper investment philosophy. Start off with an investment philosophy which suits you and then adapt and evolve as you go along the way. That is the key to long-term investing success.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, now one of my favorite questions. So the whole world has come out of a lockdown, right? So all the money people wanted to spend on travel, etc., has not been spent. So Gautam, your wife comes to you and says, Gautam, I saved a crore of rupees in this pandemic times. Here it is. Now, what do I do with it? What would you tell her to do with that money, a crore of rupees?
I think for us Indians and for married couples, I think spending on jewelry is the only expense which makes both the husband and the wife happy.
That's a unique answer, but I must say it's going to win you a lot of brownie points with many people.
So basically, see, if you invest in gold, it's very simple actually. Structurally, you know, a rupee will depreciate every year because of, you know, the inflation differential and because India imports more than it exports. So rupee will keep on depreciating. So, and since gold is priced in dollars, you'll keep benefiting from the rupee depreciation every year. So that's a natural kicker. That's the natural rate of growth which you get. Mm-hmm. Plus, some form of fixed income is good to get some regular stream of income. And at an early stage in life, have a very high exposure to equities. Also, keep at least 2 years of an emergency reserve and increase this to 5 years of living expenses, this emergency reserve. As you increase your exposure to equities over time, just increase the number of years of your emergency reserve. If you can have 5 years of an emergency reserve of what stands for your annual living expenses for 5 years, you can just rest and sleep peacefully at night. That's what I've done as well. Some of my friends ask me, why do I keep such a large amount of cash in my bank account in US? In US, checking accounts gives you basically 0% interest, basically. But what this cash in the bank lets me do is it helps me stay the course during the periodic bear markets and periodic market corrections. It lets me sleep peacefully at night, even during the rough markets. And at the end of the day, what's the point of having sacrificed so much in your 20s and 30s if you cannot sleep well at night afterwards? For me, sleeping well is equally important as eating well. And I want to maximize stress-adjusted returns. I'm happy with a few percentage points lower of return per year, as long as I can achieve it with lower level of stress. But this change in attitude happens only after you become financially independent. Till the time you don't become rich, you'll be anxious, you'll be nervous, you'll be jittery. You'll be looking at the Singapore SGX Nifty all day or every morning. Normal when you're in the pursuit of becoming rich. But once you become rich, then you realize that all this was just noise. I mean, but it's very natural. You'll be nervous when you're trying to become rich. But once you become rich, you won't be nervous after that. You'll be at peace.
Yeah. The point to note here is stress-adjusted returns. You want the stress to be low. You want a high stress-adjusted return. Okay. Asset allocation. So you've spoken to us about keeping outside some emergency cash. So that's a great idea. 2 years, increase it to 5 years or whatever it is. Talk to us, what do you think about asset allocation and how do you go about implementing your version of it?
I'll talk about my asset allocation first. So today, as of today, the bulk of my net worth is going to be in my home in US, which I'm going to buy next year. I just became a US citizen last month, so I'll be now sponsoring my wife's green card. She can join me in the next 6 months. So we plan to buy a home in US next year. That will be the bulk of our net worth, because as you know, homes in the US are very expensive. Followed by my investment, my personal investment in my India fund. That will be my, that will take care of my equity allocation. And apart from that, my balance in my bank checking account. So very, as simple as can be, just three simple assets.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. this is what really suits me. So I'll, and apart from that, some jewelry for my wife. That's mm-hmm. broadly going to be the asset allocation going forward for me. But for the average individual, again, I think when you're young, you should have a much higher, you can have even 80-90% of your allocation in equities. Live on rent for 5 years, 10 years. Till the time you don't become rich, it's fine to pay rent. It's okay, because the rental yield on properties in India is still pretty low. It's okay to stay on rent for a long time. Make use of the time, because time is the essential component of compounding. Once you can compound your money at a high rate for those 10, 15 years, you will experience 2-3 bull markets in between over those 15 years. And if you can dream big during those bull markets, you can become really, really rich. Because during a bull market which lasts for 2-3 years, many investors' portfolios just don't double. They quadruple or go up even more during a bull market. So just stay in the game to be able to experience those bull markets in between during the course of those 15 years. If you can experience at least 3 bull markets during the course of those 15 years, you will achieve financial independence for sure.
Yeah. And if you had incremental funds come to you, Gautam, would you like continue to split them between real estate, cash and stocks?
Cash and stocks. I think for real estate only, it will be only my home. I don't want to invest more in real estate, to be honest. I'm an equity guy, so I would love to deploy majorly into equities with some deployed in, further into my cash account.
And when you say equities, I know you mentioned some US stocks a while back. Do you like diversify across markets a little bit for your personal investments?
2 markets only, US and India. In my view, these are the 2 best stock markets in the world today. So I'm getting the best of both worlds, the US markets and the Indian markets as well. But India is where the heart lies, and India is where I created the bulk of my personal wealth. So it'll always have that special emotional connection for me. So I just believe in India as a country. And that is, if you look at all the big investors in the Indian market, look at Mr. Jhunjhunwala, look at Mr. Damani, look at any big investor. The one key thing which helped them stay the course for the last 20, 30 years in the market was their relentless belief in the power of India and its entrepreneurs. That is what helped them stay put during every crisis. They never gave up. They never ran out of the market. They stayed put because they believed in India. This belief in India is what is required. You have to dream big, because we are at a stage today where China was a few decades ago, and now we are about to transition to becoming a middle-income country. And that's a structural shift in a country like India. We are talking trillions of dollars of wealth creation about to take place over the next decade. One should not miss out on such an opportunity. And it's my personal conviction and belief that all investors in the world should have some allocation to Indian equities in their portfolio.
Well, that will be the day when that happens. Sir. Right now, we are struggling with what? We must be how much of a global index? 1%, 2%?
It's very small. But there's a change happening in the US as we speak. So a lot of clients are now asking for Asia funds or emerging markets fund ex-China. So a lot of people are now realizing the possibility of a geopolitical
isolation of China. Yeah, isolation of China.
Wanting country dedicated funds. And India, I think, is going to be a very big beneficiary of this new trend, because as the money goes out of China in any emerging market fund, where will the money go? Taiwan will not be investable because of China reasons. Yep. And all the other emerging markets are right now in a mess. So what is the option that fund managers have in the developed world? They will have to come back to India. The sell-off which you saw in India in the last 6 months was basically because it was a basket sell-off of all emerging market funds. That's why India also got sold off as a result. But as soon as the basket selling has gotten exhausted, you are already seeing massive FI inflows coming in again.
Yeah, that's true.
FIs always chase quality in India. They don't go for the cyclical company or the commodity company or the micro cap. No, they will go for stocks which have got decent trading volume, decent liquidity and very high quality. You have to understand that the return expectation of all this institutional money coming from the developed markets, the return expectation is so low. So what is the discount? Now, again, I'll share a very big point about the importance of having a very high quality shareholder base and what does that do to the valuation of a company. So all these FIs, when they come to India, they come in with a very low discount rate. The discount rate is driven by the return expectation, right? So since they use a low discount rate to value, since they're coming in with a lower return expectation, the discount rate which they use is low. The lower the discount rate that you use to value a business, the higher the valuation multiple. And these FIs always go for companies which can promise them 5, 10 years or more of sustainable mid-teens or higher growth. And then they bid up those stocks to the sky. Look at the valuations of stocks like Vedant Fashions or DMart and all the expensive stocks in India. Why is that happening? Because of the quality of the shareholder base, which is primarily these long-term institutions, which are coming in with a very low discount rate because the interest rates in the developed market is so low. This is what people don't just understand. You cannot use the discount rate or the cost of capital of the local market in India. You have to understand what is the discount rate by being used by the investors who are investing in that company, the FIs. They are having very low interest rates in their country, so they use a very low discount rate. And that is the reason for the high valuation multiple.
Interesting. And with these rates going up across the world, even if they go up, they're still very low. So I guess it's not like a structural risk to these stocks. And also, I think there's a trade-off on what kind of returns they're expecting.
Right.
We tend to aim for very high returns to begin with. But in a typical mutual fund in the US, that's not what they're aiming for. Because they're not undiscovered markets, right? The returns are more averaged out because it's a well-researched market.
Right. If you can deliver 10% or more here for a long period of time, you'll become a superstar in the developed market.
There you go.
Just look at the track record of all the hedge funds in this market over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Almost 99% of hedge funds have not been able to even generate double-digit returns. They have not been able to beat their benchmarks also. The same holds true for most active mutual funds in the US as well. You look at 5-year, 10-year, 15-year period. At the end of every year, there's a scorecard called SPI VA scorecard published in the US, which shows the performance of large cap, mid cap and small cap mutual funds in America. Just look at the track record over any period, 5, 10, 15 years, 95% and more of them have not beaten their benchmarks. The reason for that is if you are holding 100 to 200 stocks in your portfolio, yeah, and having this huge turnover every year, 50 to 100% every year, you'll incur costs, plus the investors pay mutual fund fees, plus you pay taxes. When you sell those, well, within the mutual fund, there's a tax advantage, I know, but even otherwise, basically all this turnover adds to costs and the fees are always a deterrent to long-term returns. In mutual funds, generally, the funds with the lowest expense ratio wins. You should ideally look for funds with low turnover and low expense ratios, ideally.
Moving on, there was something in your book that really stood out for me, was about the concept of selling a stock. And when you spoke of selling, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said, don't think of it as selling, think of it as switching. And that's a better decision-making process, because selling is like, you have to overcome a lot of bias, right? You have to it's like saying you were wrong and you have to go through that pain. But switching is, you're just saying, I'm going to just ride a better horse. So talk to us a little bit about that and what people can take away from that.
This goes back to the chapter on opportunity cost thinking. Basically, there's something called incremental CAGR or incremental IRR from the current stock price. The original cost price, which you pay for a stock, becomes irrelevant the moment you buy the stock. So forget the price you paid for a stock after you buy it, because otherwise it will forever affect your judgment. That's one. Number two, suppose you buy a stock at 100, expecting it to go to 200 in the next 3 years. The stock doubles to 200 in the next 6 months. What is your incremental expected IRR from the current price then? Zero, right? Or negligible returns, right?
Unless you change your numbers, go back and change your numbers. You get optimistic and you change your numbers again.
So, just again, change the numbers in the Excel to justify a higher target price. That is just momentum investing. That's not investing. That's momentum investing.
Right. Yeah.
In terms of incremental rate of return from the current price after the stock price is already appreciated. Now see, again, here a very fine balance has to be maintained. This is where the concept of a portfolio approach comes to play. So in any portfolio, in any portfolio, at any point of time, you'll have three sets of stocks. Some stocks will be doing badly or poorly or stagnating. Some stocks will be doing decent. And some stocks will be taking off like anything. That's how a normal portfolio operates. So you have to understand, in order to hold a big multi-bagger, like 20, 30, 40 times, you have to go through periods of time correction as well. So as long as the portfolio in aggregate can promise you a good level of return from the current price, the portfolio in aggregate, take a portfolio approach. So in the case of my India fund also, if the portfolio in aggregate can, if I can expect 15-20% IRR over the next 3 years from today's price, I'll stay put. Even though the stock may have temporarily become very, very pricey, in that case, I'm willing to hold it. But sometimes it may so happen that one of your stocks just becomes outrageously expensive, like 100, 200 teens, for example. Then you have to be dispassionate and just sell it. There's no, because in those cases, the time correction can be for 4-5 years. That's not worth it. If it's expensive, 50-60 P, I may stick with it as long as the growth is coming. But if it becomes 100 P and above, and the growth also starts slowing down, then I will sell. So it's an interplay of the valuations and the expected rate of growth. I'm willing to pay top dollar, top valuation for high growth companies, but I'm not willing to pay 100 PE for 10-12% earnings growth in India. India is a growth market. You have to look for high growth opportunities. Why waste your time with slow growth opportunities? Yeah. Many of these large cap blue chip companies have basically become very mature and they're just growing earnings at 10-12%. So why pay 70 DP for those? Pay 70 DP if you want to, but pay it for 25-30% growth for the next, where you can see it for the next 5 years. Well, if you, cases, the valuations will sustain.
So, but for those you, for those who bought Hindustan Lever in the late 90s, they learned it the hard way because for 10 years, the price didn't move. It just kept oscillating around the same thing because it was going through a growth adjustment.
Same thing happened in America as well. Between 2000 and 2013, the NASDAQ gave zero over 13 years.
Wow.
And again, because of recency bias, because the NASDAQ did well from 2014 to 2020, there were many NASDAQ ETFs and NASDAQ funds launched across the world. There's a recency bias, but you have to understand that's how most of the investment management industry or mutual funds industry work. They are primarily driven by recency bias, and investors just tend to get in at the peak of the cycle, and then the subsequent derating and the subsequent losses occur. Just focus on what you can expect from the current price. Don't focus on what has worked in the past, because investing is all about the future. So if in India, I'll give you a very good example here. So the Indian auto industry, for example, for many years, it has been in a down cycle.
Yeah.
But just see what the stock market is telling us now. When a sector goes from distress to even slightly better or less worse, you get an opportunity for making multi-bagger returns. And so over the next 2 years, not a recommendation, but study the auto industry. That is where you may get a lot of the multi-baggers, because investing is all about delta. The rate of change is maximum when a company goes from loss-making to profitable, or an industry goes from distress to less distress, then normal, good, and then very good. This is how you make the life-changing returns in the stock market. This is how you get the 10 to 20 baggers in the stock market.
So you spoke about recency bias, etc. So I think one of the ways in which you can simply become a better investor, stock picker, is to get a grip on some of these biases. So talk to us about 2-3 biases that you feel that people should really get a grip on, because it can have a disproportionate impact on their wealth creation from stocks.
I already talked about liking bias. That's one. That's very prominent. The next one I just talked about right now, recency bias, is availability bias. So the P ratio, good example, availability bias. Just because it's so readily available in front of us, we just tend to look at it as the holy grail of valuation. But a P ratio tells you nothing about the capital intensity of a business, or the execution capabilities of the management, or the return on invested capital of the business. Nothing about those things, right? Or the competitive advantage of the business. There's a lot more to making money in the stock market than just looking at P ratios. So resist availability bias. And availability bias and recency bias, both of these are combined when you fall prey to just reacting on every piece of news which comes every day, because they are recent and they're available. So just try to avoid looking at business channels as much as possible and just looking at all the sensational news headlines, because over the long run, how many of us know today, for example, that in January 2016, now this is a trivia question, do you know what was the state of the Indian markets in January 2016? What was happening that time? Today, we were in a bear market that time. And do you know the reason for the bear market that time? Because there was an oil price crash. That time we were worrying about an oil price crash, few months earlier, we were worrying about an oil price rise or oil price shock. What does that mean to, again, after a few years, we'll again forget about this and what happened in the last few months. These things have got a very short shelf life. You want to look for things which are durable in time and that which have got the longest shelf life possible. You don't want to focus on things which are of a transitory nature. That's not what long-term investing is about. Look for, in any investment, there are only two or three key variables which you need to look at. And those are the only, those two or three key variables account for 90% of the information value, the value which it provides to you. So just focus on those two, three key variables for every business and then track them over time. Forget all the macro noise. They're just there for entertainment, nothing else.
So you are based out of the US on the West Coast. Worst possible time zone for India, I would assume. Amongst the worst possible time zones, right? Is that an advantage or a disadvantage for someone who's tracking and looking at, you know, whose business is to be all about Indian stocks?
Well, I was in US between from May 2015 to late 2021 as well. And that is where I made more than 80% of my personal wealth. It didn't make any difference at all, the time difference. What's required is passion and dedication, just the love for the intellectual game of investing and a love for India as a country and the passion for India's stock market. That is what you need, really. That's nothing else. There's no other thing. Because I remember, even when I was doing a full-time job of tracking global markets, primarily the US markets, in my day job as a portfolio manager, I used to work from 8 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., come home, work on my book from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., and then from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m., 3 hours, I used to track the Indian markets in real time and then go to sleep. So it's all about this dedication, just having that passion every single day. And I'm very blessed to be in a position where I know what I'm planning to do for the rest of my life. And this is a very good place to be. So I'm very blessed and I feel very grateful.
Wonderful, wonderful. Can you share some book recommendations or read? I know you've shared two papers that people should read or be. Anything else you want to share with our viewers what they should read?
So I'll share three investing books and three non-investing books with all of your viewers. For the investing books, I'll highly recommend Investing for Growth by Terry Smith. It taught me how to invest in high quality businesses for the long term. Mastering the Market Cycle by Howard Marks is a great book on understanding how to position your portfolio for long-term success in accordance with the changes in the market cycle. And You Can Be a Stock Market Genius by Joel Greenblatt will teach you how to invest in various special situations. And special situations are a great way to generate alpha in expensive markets, because that is where you can get a lot of deep value and get the catalyst of growth as well. So these three investing books, and for three non-investing books, I'll highly recommend More Than You Know by Michael Morbison and Seeking Wisdom by Peter Bevelin, two great books on multidisciplinary thinking. And the third book I'll recommend is All I Want to Know Is Where I'm Going to Die. So I'll Never Go There, again by Peter Bevelin. One of the best books written on the principle of inversion.
Yeah, super books. Peter Bevelin is a great writer. And I have one book recommendation, The Joys of Compounding. I really, truly believe everyone should read your book. It's a fantastic book. So with that, Gautam, it's been a wonderful an hour or so of talking to you. Thank you for taking this time out and doing this with us. I wish you a great holiday next week. Enjoy all the great sights in Singapore. And all the great food. And do well. Yeah, very happy for all the success you're having.
Thank you so much, Rahul. This was fun. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Investor Hour. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this episode or the podcast in general. Be sure to write to me at info@equitymaster.com. That's info@equitymaster.com. Thank you once again and see you.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast. HD Smartcast.